Jim, I think you're up next with the StepStone Group.
Yeah, well, StepStone gets situated over here. I'm going to give just a quick intro, a little bit of background for our new trustees. We've had real estate as part of the portfolio for many decades. This has been a space that's been challenged through the COVID cycle and interest rate environment. Much of what we committed to pre-COVID was with generalist firms, so they were diversifying across property types, largely in gateway cities, so New York, Los Angeles, Chicago. And they were in value add and opportunistic funds. So we got hit with a combination of a couple factors there. One, these were more operationally heavier lifts, and through the supply chain disruptions, it was hard to get construction projects finished. Multifamily had rent moratoria in key gateway cities. Hotels were hurt, offices were hurt. So there was a lot of challenges going into COVID, and we paused the real estate program for a couple of years before we could kind of make sure we had everything covered from an asset management perspective. After we kind of re-entered the marketplace in 22, a lot of what we were doing was with more specialist firms. So an apartment-only firm that specializes in kind of secondary cities and in alternative sector funds. A lot of what we did was in build-to-rent single-family homes and industrial outdoor storage, so a little bit more industrial bias there. Real estate advice has been historically provided by the general investment consultant. In last year's RFP, we shifted that to being handled by these private markets consultants. A large reason was the vast majority of our real estate is in private funds. StepStone was onboarded, the data was onboarded in the first quarter of this year, and today is their initial meeting with the board to give you an assessment of where the program stands, what the market outlook is, and our pacing analysis to figure out how much we're going to deploy on a go-forward basis. With that, I'll turn it over to StepStone and go through the presentation.
Thank you very much. My name is Margaret McKnight, and the last time I sat in this seat, I was proposing that you select us to lead your real estate portfolio. So I want to start by saying thank you very much for placing your trust in us. We will do everything that we can to leverage our experience and our resources to live up to that. I am joined here today by Tom Hester and Brady Burden. They will do the majority of the day-to-day work with your team on the bottom-up portfolio construction. My role, and I will stay involved, is more of a top-down. And the last time I sat here, I said the first thing we would do is actually analyze your portfolio. And we've done that. So I want to share the results of that and then go through some pacing information. And if you'd like, can give you a market update at the end. And obviously would like to make this more of a discussion, so please feel free to jump in if you have questions. With that, if you could pop to page 6. So I want to talk about the structure and the policy and then the execution and the fund selection. And overall, your portfolio is fine. And it could be better, and it could be better in ways that I will show you. Selecting a specialist with a more focus on it can help bring that about. So the goal of your private equity real estate portfolio is predominantly growth. And along with that, you've got 3% to value add and 4% to opportunistic funds, which we call non-core, which are growth-oriented. It's more of a buy, fix, and sell strategy and closed-end IRR-oriented funds like what you have in PE. So that all makes sense. The overall configuration of your real estate exposure is not typical, and we need to spend more time with the senior team and the generalists because it's really a function of the higher-level allocation. Usually on the private equity real estate portfolios, we see about two-thirds core and about one-third non-core, like yours, driving the growth. In place of core, you have a real estate debt strategy. You also have real estate debt on your debt portfolio. And then I understand you're using REITs to represent the core real estate market. And that may all be fine. As I said, we want to spend more time with it. Real estate typically has four benefits. Attractive risk-adjusted returns, high current income, which most pension funds have the core allocation to cover their payouts. I understand that you are getting that from the debt portfolio, and that's more common lately as interest rates have risen. It offers protection from unanticipated inflation, which you will not get from the debt, and you'll get less of from the public equities. And it offers significant diversification from the public equity market, which, again, you won't get by having REITs as your core because they're in the indices and they're highly correlated to the equity indices. And I understand that was done placing a priority on liquidation, which is, I do respect. So again, not yet making any recommendations for change. I'm just noting that this is a little bit different of a structure than we usually see. I think the thing that we would suggest changing and where we will add value is that all you have is this allocation guideline of 3% to value add and 4% to opportunistic. When we build portfolios, we have more detailed targets that address both strategic and tactical allocations by market and by property type. And I'm going to show you that that's a way to add value, and it's been a source of loss of value in your portfolio to not have those. So what we'd like to do is work with the team to have, and they don't need to be board level, but they can be, but functional. They're more typically with the real estate teams, and more functional guidelines for how to think in a top-down way, how to allocate into the markets and property types that have the wind at their back, and more avoid the ones that are likely to face challenges. And that is a way to add value. So that's something we would like to do with your team. Next page, let's talk about the execution. When we look big picture, within the non-core equity portfolio, your actual allocations by property type are in the neighborhood of what makes sense. You've done reasonably well, that makes sense. And the portfolio is well diversified, so that's a very important risk mitigator. Two notes on that diversification. First of all, most growth portfolios are more global. This is predominantly U.S. oriented. And as an overall point, we are advocating the U.S. has considerably outperformed, so this makes sense. However, deglobalization is a major trend. The recent tariff policies have accelerated that deglobalization, and over time there is a case in a growth portfolio for a more regionally diversified portfolio. And that you execute by manager selection. And again, we'll talk to the team about that. And then secondly, the property type allocation, I think, has led to kind of underperformance or failure to outperform, depending on how you look at it. Moving ahead to the actual performance, the since inception net IRR is 5.2, which roughly meets the relevant benchmark of 5.0. So that's why I say you're doing okay. Now, there's two points I want to make there. First of all, you considerably ramped up your commitments in the last couple of years, in the 22, 23, 24 timeframes, from about $100 million a year to about $300 million a year. This was, as it turns out, excellent market timing because the market interest rates rose in 22, market prices fell, and a lot of distress was created, and they haven't yet recovered. So it's a fabulous time to be investing in non-core. So it's good to have money out there and have a lot of it out there. As a result of that, about half your portfolio is in funds that are too young to have meaningful returns. So when we say you're performing in line with the benchmark, that's for the more seasoned part of your portfolio. The second comment I want to make is when we look at the components of that performance, there's two things that stand out. There's one fund series that did particularly badly, and then in the younger funds that do still have meaningful returns, you have a real estate secondaries fund that has done very, very well, and in your total return done a lot because it's a big commitment to offset that weaker manager and bring you up to normal portfolio returns over time. Now, the trick about that is real estate secondaries funds buy things at a discount. And when they bring the new assets onto their books, they mark a huge gain as they mark those assets from the discount to their current fair value. But over time, that winnows down to a more normal return. This is very useful because it mitigates J-curve, and right now it's holding up your returns, but it will settle down, which means all other things being equal, your returns are more set to drift down and possibly into the underperforming range, which, again, you have a lot of new money out. It's hard to tell how that's going to go, but we'll do everything we can with the new commitments to help mitigate that. So that's the overall execution. Moving on to fund selection. Your funds are predominantly generalists. Some of them have leaned more into certain property types or locations, and that's been known ahead of time, but they do more than one property type. And there's nothing wrong with that. It means that you've outsourced basically the property type selection. And there are ways to use generalists that still lean into more interesting property types. I don't think there was a real focus on that. As a result, you've been systemically under-allocated to industrial, which dominated performance in the last 10 years as e-commerce came on the scene and shifted demand away from retail and into warehouses. And then you also over-allocated to office and life sciences, which have been a significant source of underperformance. Office has been drifting down for a very long time. It needs huge capex. It's very expensive to lease, so it's hard to make money in office. And although it used to be the dominant property type, but it's been drifting down over the same period industrial was drifting up, and then, of course, it got the death blow with COVID and work from home. So it's really not a good thing to be owning right now. Most office is struggling. And life sciences is a very small allocation, but it did get overbuilt in the post-COVID period. It would have been tracking to be fine by now, but for the new government policies that have really cut off investment in life sciences. So troubled sector. So sector choices matter. And they're embedded in the fund selection. When we look at the funds, most of your funds rank third and fourth quartile versus the non-core index that we use. So four of the 10 value-added funds and four of the 13 opportunistic funds came in the bottom half. It's, again, you know, the newer funds, it's too early to tell, and those have leaned a lot more into alternative sectors. Okay, let's talk about this in a little more detail then on the next page. This looks at your allocations, and this is a dashboard that we start portfolio construction with. The top section is the regional diversification, and you can see you're very heavily oriented to the U.S. Our house views is represented on the black columns on the right, a mature portfolio and then new deployment. We are not suggesting that everybody go to 47% U.S., 47% Europe, and 40%, 7% or 10% Asia, but that is market neutral. So we're just holding that out there just to show you that you're very heavily U.S. oriented. If you're outside the growth portfolio, it does make sense to be heavily U.S. oriented for reasons we can explain. The property type is what's interesting. Here you see a pretty substantial underweight at 26 versus 37 to industrial. And although it's not huge, the overweight to office at 12 versus a market neutral of 8, and it, you know, we're not putting money into office right now because it have not been for, I don't know, a long time, since well before COVID. So it's not a great place to be, and it's doing so poorly that even if it's small, it's still pulling things down. So this is how we look at a portfolio, and we center our investments around this top-down property type allocation, geographic plans, and then, of course, the risk level, et cetera. But this is the focus that we'd like to add to your portfolio. And then you do the bottom-up fund selection with a mind to getting where you want to be on these top-down categories. Yes.
So with respect to our office investments and so forth, I mean, is it correct that a lot of this has been legacy investments that we've had for a while and that we can't just necessarily get out of tomorrow?
Yes.
So we're looking at how do we improve our current situation from this point, right? We're kind of stuck with what we have.
Yes.
And now it's how do we move forward?
Yeah, so these non-core real estate funds, these closed-end real estate funds, there's not much of a secondaries market for them. So the only way to change course is really to add new and different things, is to build into what you want, and we'll lean harder into that. And, you know, we wouldn't be adding office for you. In some cases, the odd bit of trophy office can be interesting today, but like that would not be something we put on the table for you because you already have a lot of exposure. Yeah.
On the previous page, you mentioned alternate sectors. Here you have other real estate. What, could you clarify what that is?
So in your case, you have the secondaries fund, which is mixed, is a big piece of that, and some other legacy things. What we'd like to see in there is things like senior housing, where there's huge demographic support and under development. Storage can make sense in there. But you have also got, you've got a manager who's leaning into infrastructure, so you've got infrastructure in there, which there's nothing wrong with that, but it's not real estate, and that's a real estate allocation. So that's a conversation, right?
Marie?
Yes.
Two-part question. To what extent, I get the sense that there's a migration on the part of some of the office space to residential, even a conversion, if you don't count that place in New York that you wouldn't want to be in as they convert that.
Yeah.
Because it's coming down without the owner's knowledge, the IBMs are giving out. But is it possible or allowable if you have focused attention in the office market and the investments, is there any churning that goes on within that that's allowable? Can an investment or can an office piece be changed to residential if that's what they wanted to do within that, or must it stay residential or office?
Conversions are possible. A very small percentage of office buildings qualify as eligible because they need to be in the best locations where people want to be. And that if that's the case, they are more likely to work just as office. And also, if you think about an office building, it's got big, deep floor plates. And if you think about an apartment building, you're always kind of close to the windows. So there are some big structural challenges. It's incredibly expensive, high risk, and usually needs government support, which governments are moving to do. So it can be done, and it's a new high-risk investment. The flip side of that is in your portfolio, most of these office buildings are stuck, and they're levered. So on paper, really the banks own them, not you. And you may see more deterioration in value, and they're in vehicles. First of all, they're with managers who made poor choices, so you wouldn't necessarily want to put a lot of money in a new risky project with them. And secondly, they would, those vehicles tend to be out of money, so you would have to have enough people sort of making a new commitment with them.
And I don't know whether or not there's any really there, but in San Francisco, it does look as if the office market is beginning to turn around, and it seems to be more of an aggressive effort to promote San Francisco to companies to come in into the office market. Is that real or is that imagined?
It is real. The AI tenancy is leading the recovery of San Francisco. San Francisco is a unique story because it's so highly focused on one industry, the tech industry, and that makes it kind of boom and bust, and tech is on the rise. It is filling up from a very high vacancy. Unfortunately, the hard part about office is it needs a tremendous amount of CapEx. It needs to be fresh and new and exciting, and that's expensive. So most of those leases don't have positive, they're break even. They're filling the building, but the landlord's not really making money yet. They're hoping that the valuation of the office building will move as a result of it being leased, and that's how they'll make their money. There is a very small sliver of the office market elsewhere that's the best buildings and the best locations that are seeing real rental rate growth, and those are expensive. And then there are conversions of buildings, kind of the next building out, that just needs significant CapEx. It's not really a conversion, but refreshing, that are, again, kind of higher risk strategies that can pay off, but you have to bet on significant leasing that we're a little bit less comfortable doing in today's environment, because the other variable is AI is set to take a lot of white-collar jobs, which would all other things be, while it's benefiting San Francisco because we're creating it, it's putting a huge cloud over office elsewhere.
Seems to me that if we could combine these two things and create vertical data centers, you know, that's, we just take those office buildings and create new high-rise data centers, because there's, they're popping up all over the place. But that's unrealistic, totally. It just doesn't make any sense with those floor plates.
If I may, I just want to make a comment about office to residential conversions, because it is, you know, we see the headline of what's happening in New York with the Pfizer building, but keep in mind that was much different because they were actually building an apartment complex on top of an existing office building. It really wasn't a conversion. And I bring that up because conversions, we'll continue to read about them and see them. It's a small piece of the market, but if you look at downtown New York City, they've been converting office buildings for decades. They're inefficient and they're kind of like loft space, but they are getting better and they are getting still expensive, but they are getting cheaper, and in some cases they can be feasible. So it's not something that you need to foreclose out altogether, because a lot of office will continue to be converted.
Any other questions at this point?
Okay, next page. This is why property type focus matters. This looks at the last 25 years. The green line is the top two performing sectors. Most of the time it was industrial and multifamily, but it changes, and this is why you gotta be dynamic. And then the orange line is the bottom two performing sectors. And you see there's a really significant difference. And the bottom sector was led by office. And so it's always mattered at some level, but to focus on property type. But about 10 years ago, you see the lines diverge, and that's because of e-commerce coming on the scene. Retail was in the bottom of the heap because it was just getting killed, and all the demand was shifting to warehouses. And then you hit the COVID period, and industrial had another surge because of the surge of use of e-commerce, and office had another leg down because of Teams. Retail is actually on the rise now. Retail has actually jumped up into the green part of the line because there hasn't been any development for 15 years. And so they've figured out what works, what doesn't work, and the section, the properties that aren't going to work are kind of out of the pool, and the ones that are going to work are actually yielding pretty good income.
Just one question on the start. The best two and bottom two, are those... Those are determined ex post on a quarterly, yearly?
This is quarterly data from Core Holdings. So this is the beta of the market. And you'll see the better you are at predicting these, generally speaking, the better overall track record is.
Predicting the future is good for performance. Yeah.
Now,
I agree with that.
Yeah.
This is not as hard as in the stock market, because real estate moves really slowly, as you'll see. Like, whatever market update I gave you the last time I was here is basically the same update. So we have a little bit of an easier shot because we have a slower moving target. Okay, we laid out your funds by quartile. Those are the columns, and by rows. We did not name names due to the public forum. Your staff has the list. And this is where you see like the preponderance of the weight in the third and fourth quartiles. We want to shift. We aim for the second quartile. If you land in the second quartile every single time, your overall portfolio ends up in the top decile. If you swing for the fences and try to aim for the first quartile, you wind up hitting some in the third and fourth. And the actual best thing you can do for your portfolio is not lose money. So we want most of your managers in the top half. Okay, that's the overall portfolio analysis. I want to flip to the pacing plan. So you had been committing about 300 a year. We think the right pacing for the next couple of years is more like 100. And fundamentally, that is because given the market conditions, distributions have radically slowed down. Distributions have been about half of what they were. And we're projecting that they continue to be depressed, which means you're not getting money back to reinvest. This chart looks at your pacing over time. The black is what you're going to commit in each year. The gray bars is the cumulative net asset value. And then the green dashed line is the target exposure for your portfolio, and the orange is where your NAV is actually landing as a percentage of your portfolio. And because of the considerable commitments you've made in the last few years, if distributions remain depressed, you may overshoot your target by a little bit. And slowing down now doesn't really help with the sort of the 26 and 27 exposures are pretty baked. But we are slowing down, and we will keep a sharp eye on this. If distributions resume normal, we'll adjust our pacing model.
Just one comment here for 2026. This analysis is inclusive of funds that are in due diligence now that seemingly will get through due diligence and approved into the plan. And I think it's 3 to 4 funds.
Yeah, it's Ares Japan.
Yeah, yeah, a number of funds. So it's net of those amounts, which I think is about $250 million, $2 to $250 million.
Question of commitments. Sorry, I was just learning about this, but my understanding is that we hold kind of capital that are in commitments in REITs or something like that.
We have a public market proxy. We have two REIT managers that they're holding real estate assets, but they're trading as a stock, so it doesn't help from a beta perspective, but as a placeholder, it does help.
And I'm just curious, you think that is a good policy to have given this commitment piece? And because it's obviously hard to think about the performance of those guys with the commitments because they're not necessarily the same. And again, I'm not arguing it's a wrong idea yet. I don't know enough, but I'm just curious.
So public REITs are highly correlated to the stock market, and they are a very narrow valve through which you can quickly move in and out of real estate. So they tend to be very volatile. So it is quite possible that they will be materially depressed in value at the time you need the capital to fund the private commitments. But I'm sure you have a more complex portfolio and, you know, other sources of liquidity.
Yeah. So these target allocations were set in the asset allocation. And part of the reason you see this big couple years of higher allocations, we had a 10% target to real estate back then. That got changed in 2024 to bump it down. So the REITs were an easy way to have a placeholder there. I think now at a 7% target allocation, and we'll see what the next asset liability study comes. We need something that's liquid. We need something we can move in and out of. We're happy to have a conversation with StepStone about a better version. Yeah, and that will be on the docket in the upcoming couple months here.
Yeah, we have work to do in just kind of understanding the bigger picture and how everything fits together.
Let me just follow up on Maria's question and your comment. Have you had an issue historically where you have, let's say, $50 million that you've temporarily parked in a REIT, and when time comes to make the commitment, it's actually only 40 because the market has moved, right?
Not particularly. Pre-COVID, the cash flow profile of the real estate program was higher. There's a lot more organic flow, and it was more of a, can we get to the target allocation? That was the bigger challenge there. During these years, if we back up the train about 3 years, REITs had a tremendous run. And so it's more of a, we put 50 there and it turned into 80. Now we have to rebalance it down. We go through this exercise of finding the best liquid proxy for every private market allocation. We are going to have that conversation with StepStone, but we're basically, still on the old operating model until we get to the new operating model.
Yeah, just at San Jose, one of the things we did was we gave the team, if you want to park in treasuries where you know the money's there, as opposed to a market proxy where it's subject to the vagaries of the market.
Yeah. The historical approach is find the most similar version of whatever private market allocation you want in the public markets and will accept the market volatility. So that has been the historical approach. It's not the only approach, obviously, but that has been.
There's an interim approach because obviously it's not all going to get called at once, right? These are 3-year commitments, 4-year commitments. So you can figure out what your next year is going to be and maybe handle that differently. There are a lot of ways to skin the cat.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the debt pacing is interesting because you are targeting solely open-ended funds, which are like mutual funds, where you're buying into existing portfolios. And so you could deploy to target tomorrow if you wanted to. I'm exaggerating. It would probably take a month or two. But we have paced it out gradually over the 5-year period, first of all, in consideration for workload for the team to just kind of pick a fund a year. And then secondly, certainly in the early years, to leave it a little bit lower because the other one looks like it's headed toward being a little over-allocated. I don't know how much that matters to you, but this is a dial you can absolutely turn based on workload or whatnot. And I should add, Tom has already been working on the debt portfolio that you have on the fixed income side. He's a career debt expert. He leads our debt sector team, so he is, you know, very comfortable executing this. I'm kind of scratching my head at it from a top-down perspective, but we can certainly, you know, we have the skills, and he knows exactly what he wants to do to make this thing do as well as it can. So I'm not, you know, dismissing it, and we've got it covered. Well, so I think that's essentially what we wanted to cover with you today. I just want to wrap up with the next steps. I think we need you to consider the pacing plan today. Also, we'd like to add targets and ranges for the lower level allocations just to sort of be more attuned to what's happening in the markets. And we want to work to help select, to help him get the funds more in the first and second quartile. I know staff is very interested in looking at co-investments. There's ways to do that in sort of commingled sidecar funds that can be a meaningful source of fee savings. And then there's also deal by deal selection, which is a really different skill set, but we'll work through that with staff. And then we need to better understand your sort of bigger picture allocations and what the role of core is. So that's our thoughts for today. Happy to take any questions or anything else, do a market update, anything else you'd like.
Any questions for Margaret or Tom? I'll give you a chance, Brady, if you have something to say here.
I think I'm good. Thank you. Okay. That's nice to meet you.
He does all the work.
Yeah, he does all
the
work.
I do all the talking. We wouldn't be here without him.
What do you predict that the new federal housing bill is going to have on investments? Apparently, I'm hearing that it's going to eliminate a lot of private investment.
Not as significant as it sounds like. This deliberately went after what's called scatter site single family homes for rent. And that's where you have Blackstone bidding against an ordinary person and they're angry because they're outbid, and that's a political football. Because of that political football, I have never advocated for pension funds to do scatter site because there's always been headline risk. And this goes after it, and there are limitations. I'm told that there's also workarounds on some of those. So it'll probably slow that part of it down. The part of it that matters, we have a housing shortage in this country. That's why we have an affordability crisis. So you need more housing. One of the best ways to deliver new housing is in build-to-rent single-family housing. And that's where instead of building an apartment building, you're basically building a townhouse concept. So it's horizontal apartments, if you will, that are for rent. And those are very valuable because people can't afford to buy, but they're, you know, in their 30s and 40s and married with kids and want to be in good school districts and need more room. So the market needs that product. Thankfully, while the discussion of the bill put basically all new development in that category and all new investment on hold, we haven't made a single investment in that segment since the bill came up because we were concerned about where it ended. In the end, it's out. It's excluded. So that vibrant and important segment will remain viable and will hopefully be a way to deliver new supply. The other thing to watch in all of this, because this is such a lightning rod, because housing affordability matters, is watching for rent controls. And there are a lot of existing rent controls. And if you own, you know, if you're buying a building and you know the rent control situation, you can underwrite it properly. If you buy a building and then there's rent control, you can have a problem. So that's something, you know, you and that's at the municipal level. So this is where you really need to hire people, managers, to manage, who are expert in not only what is happening, but again, predictively, what's likely to happen with rent control in their markets.
David? With respect to consider a role of a court allocation, what's the attraction? I mean, so hopefully with value add and opportunistic, you hope for greater returns. At core, is it more of a hedge kind of move, or do you see returns in core to help us, you know, further along reaching our goal of terms of fixation in general?
So a core portfolio over the long term, core has delivered about a 7% return.
Sorry?
A 7% return. 6.9% is the sort of 30-year return on core. There are opportunities to do core plus, and there's dislocation. So we're targeting more like 7 to 10% for core. So this is not a high return strategy. This is not a PE equivalent. Core is the beta of the market. Core is the part of the market that demonstrably gives you protection from inflationary spikes, like we had in the 70s that were devastating, like we had briefly in the post-COVID period, like we could have if the strait doesn't open before we run out of reserves in the fall, right? So it's very useful historically to portfolios to have core. You get some of that from the non-core, but like if you just put a lot of money into real estate in 20 and 21 and it was in non-core, so unleased or in development, you didn't get the inflationary pop that went along, you know, in the post-COVID period. So that's where core would be useful. So it's, that's typically how I was taught its role, its main role was protection from unanticipated inflation. It also has virtually zero correlation with the stock markets. REITs have about a 0.8 correlation with the stock market. So it will serve you well when the market does poorly. And the non-core, again, you have transitional assets in motion. They will give you some of that, but not as securely. It's the beta of the market, and it's a market that is inefficient. So as I said, you can get more like a 7 to 10%. And I guess on the flip side, the non-core has only outperformed core over the long haul by 150 basis points. So if you, that's the median. The median was about an 8.5 versus a 7. Now, if your portfolio landed in the middle of the second quartile for non-core, you got an 11.5. So you, if you're going to do non-core, you have to be good at it to get enough spread. Otherwise, you're not getting paid for the extra risk you're taking. And that's where we want to bring you guys up. That's what's really important. Okay. And it is liquid. It is more liquid. You can't, like you, as we discussed, you're kind of stuck in this non-core.
Any other questions for our guests? Any wrap-up comments, Tim?
No, I think this is an area that's been under review for a long period of time. You know, as we said, a lot of these assets were deployed pre-COVID. You're sitting with that. You're sitting in this environment. We've made, you know, I think the first strides towards diversifying away from some of that legacy, and really looking forward to having StepStone's resources to help us deploy even more efficiently going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.